Good morning, everyone. I wanted to start off with just a little bit of a background. One, we have no disclosures. We have nothing to, we have no financial or commercial interests. Just a little background about what First Things First is. It's a little bit like First Five in California. And also Smart Support in North Carolina. So we took the best of both of those models and created a tobacco tax initiative in the state of state of Arizona. I used to live in California. Sometimes it slips out. But we have a state board that basically oversees the policy and infrastructure, kind of coordination pieces, the regional partnerships, councils. Those are the local decision-making bodies. So in some states, it's the counties. We have actually designated regions in the county. The counties, because Maricopa County, I don't know if you all know this, but Maricopa County, where Phoenix is, it's like where 80% of the population lives. So, but we have eight or six regions there at this point in time. And then we have grantees and state partners. So we actually partner a lot with our other state agencies, as well as our grantees. Some of them are state agencies, some of them are community nonprofits. So the question, when we looked at what the theme of the conference was this place matter? And we've actually had a fair amount of assessment done looking at place, looking at poverty, looking at pockets of poverty in the different regions. But we have a Quality First program. It's the Quality Rating Improvement System, which is common across the nation, the QRIS system. We've invested heavily in professional development for child care staff. So we have coaching staff and child care staff. We also have consulting teams. So we have child care health consultants as well as mental health consultants and inclusion specialists that are working in child care centers. Not all of them, but a lot of them. We also have an incentive program. So a lot of the programs that enroll in Quality First are provided incentives for their enrollment. They get these coaching services as well as some financial incentives for enrolling. There's also a large assessment option, or it's not an option. If you enroll, there's an assessment process. And it also includes coaching. So there's coaches that are specifically looking at development of curriculum in the classrooms. Then we have child care health consultants. So part of our question was looking at whether or not child care health consultation in the child care centers, if that makes a difference. So if they're a center or a home is enrolled in the Quality First program, they are offered a child care health consultant to go out and work with the child care center on health and safety standards. So it's based on Caring for Our Children, the third edition, and all of the CCHC, we missed a C there, are trained by the National Training Institute out of North Carolina, even though it has ceased doing the training. We have six certified trainers in the state. So we actually have people who do training of new staff and ongoing training throughout the year. The majority of our CCHCs have a bachelor's in nursing or a master's in nursing. But it's not required that they be nurses. Sometimes they're registered dietitians. Sometimes they're health educators as well. So as part of the Quality First model, we have this assessment process. So we look at the environmental rating scales as part of the ECHRS, the ITERS, and the FICRS. If people don't know what those are, it's the Early Childhood Environmental Rating Scale, the Infant Toddler Environmental Rating Scale, and the Family Child Care Environmental Rating Scale. And in each of those is a personal care routine subscales. So that's the point of analysis that we're using here. Also, all of our centers that get to the 3 to 5 star rating are administered the class scale, which is looking at the classroom assessment scoring system, just looking at those interpersonal relationships between teachers and the children that are in the childcare setting. And First Things First also has a quality first point scale. So we're looking at staff qualifications, the administrative practices, as well as the curriculum. So our centers get assessed quite extensively. So when we're looking at the personal care routines subscale, we're looking at how teachers greet children when they're coming into the center, what happens when they're leaving the center. So it's greeting and departing. We're looking at the subscale related to meals and snacks. What are the meals, how are they administered? Are they family, family style. Yes, sorry, lost the word. Family style, and looking at the quality of the snacks. We're looking at the nap and rest scales. We're looking at toileting and diapering, and I must say, I'm not a CCHC. And when I looked at toileting and diapering, I thought, oh my God, there's so much involved in this. You know, it should be just, you know, whip the thing off, throw it away, throw it and put another one on. There's much more involved when it's in health and child care. Looking at kind of the health practices that are existing in the child care and looking at the safety practices. There's actually a subscale in the safety practices related to hot tubs and pools, which I thought is kind of interesting. You know, it's like I've not been to a child care center that had a hot tub or a pool, but that could exist. So each of these scales have different points associated to them. So we look at the overall Ecker score, which is the environmental rating system, as well as the personal care routines subscales. So a little bit more about child care health consultation. They also, the child care health consultants go in and they actually do a national health and safety assessment tool. They have a collaborative model of consultation, so they're working closely with the coaches, as well as if there is a mental health consultant or an inclusion specialist, they're working together as a team to provide coaching to that center. They also have individualized instruction and training, so they have a clinical pathway that they're following. And they have an on-site health and safety specialist training, so if they can identify someone within a child care center who would be designated as a health and safety specialist, they do a training so that person actually becomes the specialist in that center. And then the CCHC acts as a mentor for that person, so that there's kind of someone who's identified to have more content knowledge around health and safety, but at the same time has someone else to call. So you don't always know, so at least you know enough to say, I need to call for additional help. And then it also, Tier 3 also is including the Tier 2 and Tier 3 services, or Tier 1 and Tier 2 services. Tier 1 or Tier 2 services give more of a short-term consultation, and that's kind of more ad hoc. If there's a special health and safety issue that's been identified, I use the example of an outbreak of lice. So there's an outbreak of lice in the child care center. There's someone who has to come and actually talk with the center, and so that they don't go running around treating every single child, or you know, putting these chemicals on every child, but figuring out that there's a process to go through to eliminate lice. And also if there's a child that's newly diagnosed with asthma, which I think, you know, I'd like to talk with you later about this whole model, because I think that there's some real interest in, you know, children and those triggers in child care centers, but also looking at, you know, how to help train child care staff to be able to administer the medication, to understand what those triggers are. But that's more of a short-term kind of consultation. If there's an ongoing consultation, then it becomes a Tier 3. And tier 1 is basically the child care health consultant collaborates with the Quality First coaches And it's more of a telephone consultation model, so that they call them up and they say, hi, is there anything going on? How are things going? Are there issues that are coming up? And then once a center is enrolled in the Quality First program, they're assigned at a tier one level, in which case the child care health consultants will actually go out and, you know, call. We call it a meet and greet. Maybe they're ready for services. Maybe they're not. Maybe they're getting, you know, inundated with coaching services, so they're not quite ready for a child care health consultant to come out just yet. So we've got these three tiers, and I think the model actually works really well because they can move between different tiers. They can go from a 1 to a 3, they can go from a 1 to a 2 to a 3, or they can be at a 3 and say, you know, we've met certain standards, there aren't things that we need to continue working on, but they move down to a tier 1, unless something else is identified, and then they would move up to a tier 2 or a tier 3. So there's a process, there's a fluidity to it, which is actually part of, that's one of the issues that we identified when we were doing our analysis. Because we were trying to say, okay, is a tier one always a tier one? Is a tier three always a tier three? Then there's some fluidity in it. So we thought, okay, does place matter? You know, if we look at the scores on the environmental rating scale and also the subscale scores for the personal care routines, will it vary? Will those scores vary for centers that are located in high poverty areas to compared to non-poverty areas? Poverty is kind of a static, not a static issue. You can live in it's interesting. I used to live in California, and I worked in San Mateo County, and there's a town called Atherton. Anybody's ever heard of Atherton? And there were high poverty areas in Atherton. You can't buy a house for under like $2 or $3 million in Atherton. It's the middle of Silicon Valley. But there were definitely some high poverty areas in Atherton, and I kept thinking, well, where are they? So in every community, there are pockets of poverty. People that are working in the McDonald's or working in the hotels or working in, you know, the service community. So there's not a this is an affluent area, so there's no poverty here. So identifying poverty areas is a little more of a complex issue. We also thought that the scores on the ERS scores and the personal care routine scores would differ based on the level of CCHC services. We thought, okay, it's worth asking. Will there be a variation? And what is the center quality rating scores? Is it illustrated by the scores on the scales? So we have, I think there's almost 1,000 centers and homes that are enrolled in the Quality First program throughout the state. We decided to just limit our analysis to centers, child care centers. Even though I'm thinking, you know, we might want to expand that and actually compare the centers and the homes. We looked at the scores for the ERS and the personal care routine subscale. And again, these are, once they're enrolled into the Quality First program, they are assessed. So they get their first rating. And then they get their second rating 2 years later. So we also looked at how to calculate low poverty areas based on the poverty of the geographical location or where the center is located. We thought, okay, that's the best approach we can do, and we're using the American Community Survey from 2008 to 2012. So what happened between 2008 and 2012? It's called the Great Recession. They don't call it the Great Depression, depending on where you live, but it's the Great Recession. So there was definitely some, you know, we're looking at poverty and defining poverty in a specific way, which may or may not be the best approach. We're actually looking at how to revise that piece. That's what we use. We're also looking at comparing the tier levels of CCHC services, whether or not it made a difference if they were in a tier one or a tier three, and comparing it all to the quality rating scales as well. There's a lot of limitations to this. And my colleague, Rupa Iyer, and I, we went back and forth going, I don't know, this doesn't make sense. Maybe we need to clean up this data. Maybe we need to figure this out differently. So we're really looking at how this works, because we're using administrative data. We collect data on all the centers that are enrolled in Quality First, pretty extensive data. We're looking at, we just started a new data system, data collection system for the CCHCs, that we'd be able to actually link what happens in the dose of the response and the tier level and how it changes in the CCHC system. But that just started the end of November, or July. Sorry, I got 5 minutes. I better go quick. I'm going to get to the data. So we looked at the centers. We did a cohort study. We looked at the centers that were tier 2 or 3. We had 299 centers. Some of them were public school-based, Head Start, early childhood special education programs. And then we looked at private child care centers. We also looked at the same in cohort 2, which was the CCHC tier 1. So we thought, okay, if they were exposed to CCHC services, tier 2 or 3, which is on-site consultation, kind of looking at it based on the poverty level for the American Community Survey, we actually found that the ERS scores by poverty level didn't vary a whole lot, that the personal care routine scores that also did not vary a whole lot. But what was really surprising, it was looking at the scores of centers that were the tier 1. Those were the centers that were only getting phone consultation. And their scores were actually higher. So we're trying to figure out why they were higher. Didn't make sense to us. So again, we looked at the star ratings, because the QRIS system, there's, you know, 5 stars. I think most of the states are using a 5-star rating or 5-level rating. So we looked at it and we thought, okay, does that make a whole lot of difference in terms of the PR, the personal care routine scores, or the average ERS scores? And again, there was not a whole lot of difference. So we're thinking, okay, well, what's causing this? What's part of this? How do we unpack this? So what we expected was that the low poverty, the centers in the low poverty areas with limited CCHC services would actually have lower scores because they weren't getting a whole lot of intervention. But they were getting coaching. They may have been getting mental health consultation. But we weren't able to pull that in because the data is not there yet. The score varied, but it's not the direction we thought it was going to be. Oh, now I'm 3 minutes. And also, the goals that are part of the CCHC interventions are different than what is being measured in the personal care routines. The CCHCs have a whole different approach to the improving health and safety in childcare settings, and it's more based on the caring for our children standards, which are higher standards than licensing. So we're looking at, okay, what does that mean for us? And realizing that there's an importance in aligning goals between the coaches, CCHC, and other specialized technical assistants. So we learned a lot of lessons. So the next steps, and I don't know if, Rupa, do you want to talk about it?
Yeah,
quickly, you've got 2 minutes.
The good news is I talk really fast, so. And this is the only slide I want to talk about. One of the reasons that I came up is because this is under procurement, so instead of letting her what she can say or not say in this meeting, I thought it's easier for me to talk about what is allowed because our RFP is getting ready to be on the street soon. So we are going to launch a Quality First, Arizona's Quality First validation study. Phase 1 will be validating our rating scale, but phase 2 of our study, specifically as we recognize the limitations of the data, we have to not look at as Karen presented earlier, currently in our study, most of the results we looked at using the personal care routine subscores. We do not have the checklist data yet. The system has developed around 20% of the 9,932 programs that's in quality first are entered into the system. So in probably in another 6 months, we'll have the checklist data in along with the PCR, the personal care routine to compare. And it is great to talk to some other state folks today to understand that they are not completely aligned. So looking at to the national health checklist for child care health consultation and the personal care routine, if you're not exactly looking at the same thing, trying to align and say if CCHC is not functioning or not, because they have slightly different goals, so it is to align. So our next phase will be, we are going to be looking at the individual components. If you remember the little hand in the beginning, which you show different components, so we'll be looking at the fidelity of each of the components, CCHC being one of them, and then we'll be looking to see how they are working together to make a change in quality, or the tiers of quality, our program moving from a 1-star to a 2 to 3 to 4, and are any of this individually or in combination playing a key role in that. So I think for us to come back in next meetings to come and say whether this really works, because right now we found our hypothesis is not showing, but I think it's because of more than anything data limitation. So thank you.
Thank you all. Very, very nice presentations, all of you. We learned a lot of good information. I'd like to open it up for questions for any of our panelists.
That's what actually we're hoping we're going to be able to do with the new data system, Kathy, because right now what we have in our data system is linking it to whether it's tier 1, tier 2, or tier 3. That's the information that we have. So with the new data system, we can actually look at where that fluidity is, whether they started as a 1 and went to a 3, or they started as a 3 and went to a 1. We'll be able to actually identify that, which is why we kind of created this, the data system that's linked to those centers. So you're right. There's a lot of limitations to this.
At least in our system, when you look at overall environmental rating scales, you know, personal care and routine is one of the subscales. For us, the things that drop programs from a 3-star to a 2-star, you know, where we call it, program will kill me if I don't remember this. It's a rising star, progressing star, then quality. So you call 3 stars where the quality starts. For us, when we saw when we looked at the scale of environmental rating, where our programs are having a hardest time was not with personal care routine, it was with instructional support. So that's where we are seeing, as a program, it's in the quality of feedback loop and instructional support is where they were scoring down. But when you look at in personal care routine, you know, again, because their overall score is lowering in depending on their environmental rating scale, then they have something called a quality improvement plan. So many programs do put personal care routine, the health and safety as one of the area they want to improve. So the thing that we are trying to now look is to see, is a coach giving personal care routine alone giving enough support to move the program, or are those program where they are also a child care health consultant? And when their goals are aligned, so a coach is telling them do this, this, this in a classroom, and then there's a child care health consultant who is coming in talking about nutrition, physical activity, is that combination making the program progress through? So for us, PCR score in itself with ERS, they are definitely highly correlated when you look at how programs move through improvement. It's the instructional support where we see is dropping programs down the rating scale. Yeah, like I said, if you approach it from a Maslow's hierarchy, you know, basic health needs before you go up. We are seeing the programs are meeting when you go to 1 to 2 to 3, the basic needs are met and they are meeting the threshold. But when you look to 3 to 5, I think it will be very interesting to see are they still staying at a 3 or are those health needs. When I heard about the LAUP program, I will be curious to go back and see the difference between center and home. So right now we club 3 to 5 together. We have not really looked at 3 versus 4 versus 5. So probably what you're talking about, is it flooring at some point at 3, or are we really picking up going from basic needs to really the higher quality of PCR? We really haven't looked at that. But I think it's a good question to look at. National QRIS, Quality Rating and Improvement System, have every state's program, and especially INQIRE, INQIRE, in case my pronunciation is not self-explanatory. INQIRE group has the website where you can go and look at the tools. So for us, it'll be environmental rating scale and class assessment score. We can't take any credit for it. It's already valid and reliable measures that's out there that you can go and look at. The first things first point scale, which is looking at mostly the ratios in the classrooms, the size and the administrative, that's our tool, and that's available there too for you to look at. It's the QRIS national network, and you can put in their compendium. That's the word. You can put the state compendium data, and every state's measures and parent stakeholder surveys, parent surveys, all are available for you to look at.
Concept of control has been very challenging. When you look at even our pre- and post-test results for the medication and devices course, while there was significant improvement, there was a lot of room for continued improvement in understanding even the controller medication versus the reliever medication, why it should be used daily, even if there's no symptoms. You know, what is it working on? That inflammation, the chronic underlying condition of asthma. However, what we do see is that introducing those concepts in the child care provider environment stimulates conversation with those parents. We get a lot of callbacks. I spoke with a parent. They did not know that there was a controller medication. They didn't know what control looks like for their child. So we also talk about the Baylor's Rules of Two, where we talk about if you're using, you know, the quantity of reliever medications, the nighttime awakening. So we talk about all of these concepts and follow up with literature and pamphlets for the child care center and a toolkit that they can share with the parents to really start these conversations on what control looks like. And we really shouldn't be giving out Buterol throughout the day, nebulizer, you know, at the child care setting. So, but it is very challenging. It is challenging because the other side of asthma management folks don't know, aside from the albuterol.
I have a question, though, about the cost of the medication. I mean, if that's a factor to be considered.
You know,
the controller medications are fairly expensive.
Right. Now, that's true, because, you know, I've had to say, you know, I'll get that next month myself on my controller medication. So they are expensive. But when we asked the question of parents, so we did a sub-survey with parents to find out, you know, did your doctor ever talk to you about these other set of medications? Many of the parents were not aware of the controller medications or had not been prescribed. And we were focusing on Head Start settings, so the cost wasn't a barrier because they did have provisions for the prescription medication because they were on Medicaid program. So it was a lot about the knowledge and understanding. And I don't want to give my child medication every day because it's that concept, we take medication until we feel better. But with asthma, even when you're feeling better, you're treating that underlying inflammation, so still take it. So it's that whole paradigm shift as well that I need to take this every day or give it to my child every day.
I'm concerned about the quality of health training for the Head Start staff.
Mm-hmm.
In my experience, they usually train very well. Is something going on in Atlanta that we don't
know? Well, no, I wouldn't say in Atlanta. No, I wouldn't say in Atlanta. I would say that in general, and a lot of states have actually initiated child care training specifically around asthma. You see, like, Florida actually started one. A lot of there's 36 states that are funded by the National Asthma Control Program, many of whom have taken on working with early child care providers in enhancing their ability to care for children with asthma. And we have a professional development system like many others. There are no courses focused on asthma management in child care settings. And when we worked with DECAL and we did at their annual meetings and we did surveys, there was a dearth of information available, readily available, to prepare child care settings to administer medications, recognize signs and symptoms, and then work on their indoor and outdoor environments to be more conducive. And so it's not an anomaly in Georgia. I think we're noticing across the state that there's some opportunities here. But we seize this opportunity to create a curriculum in order to fill the void.
Yeah.
So I'm just struck, Francesca, by yours and Bert's presentation, and these family environments, and especially in California, where the kids play outside or inside, can, especially on bad air days, can facilitate asthma, right? So there's got to be some kind of connection between the two of you in terms of thinking around how we're better assessing child care environments to really understand not just children who have asthma, but in terms of looking at epigenetics, the predicating the risk for getting asthma from early childhood exposures. And I'm just, when we should be concerned about what kids are eating and what effect it might have on them getting asthma. We should be concerned about what kids are breathing and their effects on getting asthma. So I'm wondering whether there's been any kind of raw assessment data you've done on either your environments or even in thinking for your food and activity, which is all connected to asthma as far as I'm concerned. Any sort of thinking around that in terms of predicting asthma or people getting asthma and asthma prevalence?
Yeah, so we've done some air quality studies, and we recently published a poster around the pockets of asthma in the EPA non-attainment areas, which are areas that have not met the quality measures, and of course, as we expect, significant correlation to those. And when we work within the state of Georgia, our nutrition and obesity program, we are sometimes singing different songs. You know, they got to get outside, they got to play more. And I'm like, well, the air quality is orange. You know, they probably should be outside earlier in the day before it's high noon. So there's options, not just stay inside. But then what are those, you know, is there a heart rate that we need to get to? What are some other sub-measures, even if they are doing physical activity indoors, that would still meet the requirement if the outdoor air quality is poor? And there's a lot more conversations and, you know, synchronization that needs to happen with, you know, our programs. But
I can mirror what she had just said. We, in a separate project, had done some air quality studies, and we used child care centers and put up equipment there. And one of the things we were interested in, not as much at the centers, but we're looking in the communities when the air quality was bad or perceived to be bad, or parents keeping their children inside and not getting opportunities for physical activity. In these specific communities in South Los Angeles, which are by our ports, so there's oil refineries there. There's also a lot of diesel pollution as well from the trucks coming back and forth, that we did see increased asthma incidents in these areas, and parents were keeping them in. Now, at the family-based sites, it was interesting. They were more, as I mentioned earlier, more set up to have inside activity. The outside sites, a lot of them that were with, affiliated with schools, they had similar policies and procedures in place where if the air quality was a certain level or the temperature was going to reach a certain point in that day, the kids were kept inside, but it did reduce opportunities, you know, for physical activity from our perspective, but you're not being exposed to, you know, issues that are going to affect your asthma.
So in the center,
correct.
If you're at risk for asthma because they haven't got the space or they...
It hasn't been set up in... Right, you know, and...
That's kind of like an injustice going on there.
Yeah, no, it's how they intersect, and it sounds like we've both been doing work coming from the same angle, so, yeah.
Okay, we have time for two more questions. Jennifer, and then this gentleman, and then...
numerous studies out there that showed California Resource Board just did one a couple of years ago that showed that these kids are really exposed to a lot of what we call volatile organic compounds. And that's the whole issue around the asthma and asthma prevalence. And you know, you mentioned health and safety issues, and I just wondered, where does this whole green cleaning or exposure to clean chemicals, where does that fit into this whole
thing?
In the curriculum for creating asthma in the environment, and we specifically talk about those asthmogen chemicals. I mean, I've gone to a center doing a training and it was high soil fresh, and I was like, I have asthma, I can't sleep in a tent. You know, like I was about to, you know, and they were laughing. I was like, I know you're doing the right, you're with the right fear, want to make sure it's clean and sanitary. But, you know, there lies the conversation. How else do we do that? And then a larger conversation from the system is with our State Department, as they're doing training on, you know, the cleaning measures and sanitation, do we need to have to have some other alternatives? Maybe seventh generation, you know, typical stuff. You know, there's a lot more system and policy level change that needs to happen to facilitate this new topic better as well.
And I'm just sitting here listening to this conversation. For us, we, like I said, we are one of the state agencies, but not the Department of Health Services. So I'm sitting here just, I was just talking to Karen, and I'm like, as I'm thinking about this study, and we look at the health and safety standards, the CCHC, kind of in silo from our data world, we do have access to Department of Health Services asthma data, so I'm thinking, and we get that for our needs and assessment. So now in my head, I was thinking through all the analysis steps. I'm like, okay, bring in the asthma data, but probably only for certain centers and homes. And then to think about child outcomes and the dosage, because if kids have asthma and they're absent in classroom, then you look at the study without that piece of the data to say, oh, the quality improvement is not working because the child is actually not there for a completely different reason, nothing to do with the five components that we're looking at. But now I know to make the call as soon as I go home to pull the data together.
Well, definitely stay tuned for emails from us because we were actually just talking about some of these same topics from yesterday, and we plan on sending out a call for possible research efforts to talk about some eco-friendly research efforts in the coming years, months. So keep up and stay on the lookout. And please, as Jennifer mentioned, come to our session on tomorrow at 2:30. Environmental health. Okay, thank you.